This episode of Addiction, an Hour with Hour, is brought to you by Gaming Laboratories International. GLI is a world-class testing, inspections, and certification company committed to delivering the highest quality land-based, lottery, and iGaming testing and assessment services around the world. GLI provides suppliers, operators, and regulators with expert guidance for navigating the future of gaming and ensuring gaming innovations meet regulatory standards with confidence in more than 710 jurisdictions. For more information, visit GamingLabs.com. Hello and welcome to Addiction, an Hour with Hour. I am one of your hosts, arguably the less important half. In fact, I'm probably not even a half, the less important quarter. I'm John Bruford, and we're joined by your other host, three quarters, as I like to call him, Dr. Michael Hour. Dr. Hour, hello.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Yes, I'm okay. I'm a little excited about today's guest, but I think I say that every week.
Don't get too excited.
No.
Let me ask the questions, please.
Of course. But I do have some good questions today.
All right. Okay.
Let's see. So we're joined by, Michael probably knows what my first question is going to be based on what I'm about to say. But we're joined by distinguished professor John Elhai, who is a clinical psychologist at the University of Toledo. Now, that's not Toledo in Spain, which we established in the preamble. But John, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
First question for you, right? How'd you become a distinguished professor instead of just a plain old professor?
Well, I was a full professor until a couple of years ago at my university and at a lot of universities in the U.S. Some of the professors are nominated each year and given this award of distinguished professor. So a couple of years ago, I got that award.
Okay, so it's a peer awarded thing. It's not like TripAdvisor. You get the top professor marks and you become distinguished. It's not nothing like that.
It's not that distinguished.
That would be way cooler, wouldn't it?
It's more than a normal professor. It's an upgrade.
It's
an upgrade.
It's like a super professor.
It's like a general compared to colonel.
Right.
That's nice. I was just wondering because I think Michael's got his eyes on a distinguished professorship.
Go for it.
Where?
Go
for it. I'm just trying to encourage him to aim for the stars. Yeah. So, John, my first question isn't actually work-related, okay?
Okay, yeah.
I noticed, because you've got a Wikipedia page, which I think is pretty cool. Like, I've got one mention on Wikipedia. That's it. I mean, I'm nothing and nobody. You've got a Wikipedia page. So, like, that's pretty awesome. And your Wikipedia page says you were born in Baltimore, Maryland.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, I can't speak for Dr. Hour, but I think I am going to speak for Dr. Hour when I say that Baltimore's finest son, possibly greatest son, is the magnificent John Waters.
Right. That's very true. Famous filmmaker. Yeah.
Yeah. Author. Yeah. All-round good guy and genius. And one of the all-time great guest stars on The Simpsons.
True.
That's very fair to say. Now, my first question is, do you know him or have you ever met him?
No and no. This would be great too.
That's really disappointing, especially as he's spent his life making movies in and around Baltimore,
which makes
him really unusual.
Yeah. Of course, I haven't lived in Baltimore for a long time, but all of my family still lives there. But it is my hometown and where I grew up.
Well, if you wouldn't mind asking them if any of them might have met him, because
I doubt any awesome. Of us in my family are that important, but I'll certainly ask.
I think, from what I can gather from reading his books, I think the main way to meet him is to have a beehive hairdo, and at some point he'll approach you and tell you you've got magnificent hair. Obviously, I am never going to meet him based on that criteria.
but you two are in with a shout. So, John, what's the nuts and bolts?
Stop it. So I'm entitled for a question two now, okay?
Yeah, of course you can. You're three quarters of this podcast.
Okay, so Toledo is in Ohio. Cleveland is in Ohio. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is in Ohio.
Yeah.
Sadly, I never been there. Have you been there?
I have not been to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I believe it is in Cleveland.
Yes.
And some of the biggest cities in Ohio would be, in addition to Toledo, Columbus, Cleveland.
Of course.
Cincinnati would be another one of the big ones.
They have, they had a Formula One race there, or at least NASCAR or something, didn't they? Mm-hmm. Cincinnati. Mm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, famous for sports, some of these Toledo cities for sure.
It's a sure sign of a place where there's not much to do.
Totally exactly.
Kidding. Totally kidding.
Us Ohioans forgive you.
That's good. That's good. So what's sort of the nuts and bolts of what you do? Do you have specialisms? What's your thing?
So I teach and do research at my university in the Department of Psychology at the University of Toledo. And also I'm involved in the Department of Neurosciences and Psychiatry. In terms of my research, what I'm interested in and what I publish on is I'm interested in why some people engage in excessive use of the internet, excessive smartphone use, excessive social media use. And I'm specifically interested in psychological constructs, in particular mental health symptoms that might drive some people to excessively use the internet. For example, we know that people with depression are more likely to excessively engage in the internet. And so I'm also interested in mediating mechanisms, like why do some people who are depressed excessively engage in the internet, but others who are not depressed, others who are depressed don't excessively engage in the internet. So psychological mechanisms that might explain why some people with psychopathology excessively engage in the internet.
How the hell do you research that?
So we do cross-sectional survey studies, often with college students. We sometimes also objectively look at what they're doing on their phones by using apps like iPhone's screen time feature to see how much time they're spending on their phone. And then we look at correlations with psychopathology constructs, survey measures, things like that, to try to determine the strength of the relationship with things like excessive social media use. And also we look at kind of causal modeling to see if we can look for explanatory variables that might mediate there.
This is probably a little bit early for this question, but I'm going to just go for it anyway, because fuck it. This might be a really daft question, or it might be like just a super basic part of what you do, right? But in a lot of studies, particularly ones where there aren't obvious physical things to measure, you're relying to a large extent on self-reporting from people. Yeah?
Yeah.
Now, if that's the case, is one of the things that you measure in order to sort of, I'm really not sure how to phrase this, so bear with me, right? Is it like, do you have to sort of assess the person's, and I can't think of a less simplistic way to put this, but I think you'll get where I'm coming from. Do you have to be able to measure and report the depth of their depression as a factor in that? And how the hell is that solely down to self-reporting?
Yeah, so we use standardized self-report measures of psychopathology. Like, for example, we use standardized survey measures of depression, anxiety, and so forth. Even better would be to use structured clinical interviews, but often in most of my studies, we don't have the resources to actually individually interview people. So instead, we give them these self-administered questionnaires that are reliable and valid, used in a lot of studies. And then the same issue applies for measuring their social media use and smartphone use. We ask them with self-report. The problem there is that with regard to when people report how frequently they use internet technology, they're often inaccurate. So that's why some of our studies, we also include the objective estimates so that we can look at what they're actually doing and how much they're actually spending time on these media.
I mean, what would be really interesting was if Apple, for example, with the screen time feature on the phone, you know, send out questionnaires, you know, or you know, psychometric instruments and collaborated with researchers. Did they ever do that? I mean, has there ever been a study that collaboratively with Apple or any of these companies?
Some of these companies do. Apple has a research component, but most of these companies usually use their own internal researchers. They're not as often to collaborate with other researchers because it means sharing data, and a lot of these companies don't like to share their data, to be honest.
Of course. I mean, and that's important what John asked before, and I know why he asked it, I think, because, you know, do people even have the capacity to sort of, you know, assess their own situation? But it's psychology, right? It's psychology, it's psychiatry.
Yeah.
It's all about psychological symptoms that, you know, either, like you say, in a clinical interview, have to be assessed by a psychologist or a psychiatrist, or the person fills out a self-administered questionnaire.
But does that mean then that it's a lot of it is down to the quality of the questionnaire?
Of course. No, look, I mean, there are questionnaires, sorry to jump in here, they are standardized. And standard, like for example, you are meantime familiar with the problem gambling severity index. So the problem gambling severity index is a 9-item questionnaire with questions like, you know, on a day when you lose, do you come back the next day and gamble more? Never, sometimes, almost always. Then do you lie to family members, etc., etc. And if you score more than, you know, 8 points, you are a problem gambler per definition. So somebody came up with the concept, okay, this is problem gambling and this is it. And that's what psychology is. That's what psychiatry is, except you have like really objective, I think, I mean, John Elhai, correct me if I'm wrong, except when you have like really, really, you know, symptoms you can observe objectively, like, you know, a person talking to themselves. They're obviously in a stupor, you know, they are, you know, very, you know, they are bipolar and in a manic phase, or, you know, on the other hand, you know, in the depressed phase. But otherwise, it's all about questionnaires. And, you know, psychologists agree, okay, this is depression, right? This is you know, neuroticism. This is, I don't know what, you know, gambling addiction. This is it.
Right. I get you. And obviously standardization is a really important part of that. But I guess what I'm sort of asking is, so questionnaires, surveys and all those things are a science in themselves. I mean, they're extraordinarily difficult to do. And so standardization would help enormously with that. What I'm asking is, are you asking in questionnaires, are you saying, do you do this or that, or you know, do you do this to this extent or to this extent? So you're using the questionnaire, and I appreciate every mental health professional that's listening to this is going to say, duh, when they hear what I'm saying. But so you're actually asking them about their behaviors, which they will be able to report with some accuracy, presumably, hopefully, rather than saying, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being not very depressed at all, 10 being, oh my God, I'm not getting out of bed this week, how depressed are you today? So you're not asking them to self-report on that. You're asking them to self-report on behaviors, and the behavior answers funnel them into the groups for the statistical analysis later. Is that about right?
So the standard kinds of questionnaires that we use for psychopathology research, depression, anxiety, whatever, eating disorders, for example, they tend to map onto the symptoms in the DSM-5, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. Some of the questions that are in the DSM-5 that also correspond to the questions that are in the survey measures, some of them ask about behaviors. Other questions ask about more internal experiences. So questions like you mentioned, John, like on a scale of 1 to 10, you know, how depressed do you feel? The better survey measures try to improve by using benchmarks, like how using benchmarks of frequency or intensity. Because if I just ask you on a scale of 10, how depressed do you feel? Your 3 might be a 7 for me, even though we both have the same level of depression, like, because different people rate things differently based on numerically. So some of the better measures try to anchor the ratings to, oh, how often does this happen to you? 1 to 2 times a week, 3 to 5 times a week, that sort of thing. But there are always going to be limitations of self-report research. We try to do in my lab to minimize some of the limitations. The big way to limit these ways of impinging on responding is that we make our studies anonymous. We let the research participants know that we're not going to be tracking their identity in relation to their reports, so that we tell them, like, you can feel free to answer honestly. You're no matter what you say, we're not going to, you know, judge you or something like that. That's a big way to overcome those sorts of limitations.
And I think what's also important to mention, because we are so gambling focused, is if somebody, you know, is in like a, you know, clinical assessment, let's say for depression or eating disorder, they might not have, you know, or it's less likely for them to conceal their behavior because they're actively seeking for help. Whereas often, you know, when somebody in a gambling company context, you know, is asked, can you afford, you know, how much you're losing, answer those 9 questions, they, you know, don't answer honestly, because what's their, you know, what's their motivation to do so?
Yeah. Like in a clinical setting, you might have a reason to overstate your symptoms because you really desperately need to get help. Yeah. Or if you're being evaluated for court purposes and you've committed a crime and you're trying to say that you had depression or PTSD, which is why you committed the crime, then also you might have a reason to overreport your symptoms. Mm. But in research, it's different. You don't have those sorts of incentives.
In your on your website, you're mentioning FOMO, right? I mean, it's become quite popular lately. I mean, I've heard about FOMO only a couple of years ago for the first time. Can you explain what's FOMO?
Also, just before you do that, I want to just point people back to a previous episode, because do you remember the guy we had on with crypto trading?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And he said FOMO was a leading aspect of.
Absolutely. Yeah, sure. And I mean, even more than in gambling, because in gambling, I mean, everything is random, nothing happens. But in crypto, you're really, you know, something is happening while you don't engage with it, right? The markets are moving and shaking, things go up and down.
Yeah.
And FOMO is quite, can be quite essential here. And they also play with this enticement, don't they, the operators?
Yeah. So FOMO is the fear of missing out, and it really involves 2 components: the fear of missing out, the apprehension of missing out on socially rewarding experiences, and also the corresponding need to stay constantly connected with what's going on in the people in your network, so that you don't miss out on experiences. And you can imagine that FOMO is a real driver of internet addictions. You know, people want to, the people who really experience this fear of missing out, they want to constantly check their phone and their social media to make sure that they're not missing out on something. And FOMO is also really related to negative affectivity. So it's usually conceptualized that people who are depressed, anxious, as a result of that, they are more likely to experience higher levels of FOMO.
And do you think that this is something that the technology to some degree also created? I mean, because before you wouldn't have, you know, all of this novelty, all of this content constantly. If you go on Instagram, I mean, you can scroll infinitely, you know, until the day you die, and you will have new pictures, new videos every 5 seconds. And that simply was not the case before. do you think that something that's really that that the technology actually created that to some degree?
Yeah, I mean, I think many people have had FOMO for a long time. I mean, if you're like, I remember being young in college and I wanted to go out and didn't want to miss anything, you know?
Yes.
But you couldn't be everywhere at all times in person. Whereas with a smartphone, just like you're saying, Michael, it's like you can, there's an incentive to keep staying on online because you can always find out, well, what else is out there? What am I missing? You never feel like you have closure because there's always something that could be going on that, that you can easily look up and hear about. So I think kind of technology has really triggered enhanced FOMO in some individuals.
You know, Facebook Reels.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're familiar with that. It was new to me. I was off Facebook for years and I signed back up about a year ago. And so now there's Reels and I'm looking, I'm like, fuck, you know what I mean? This is like, I get it. I've seen people in airports like on TikTok and they're just scrolling. I'm just like, that's just fucked up. And then I find myself doing it.
Yeah.
But listen, I don't know if anybody's ever reported this with you, but I made it to the end.
You found the end? Congratulations.
Facebook gave up.
That worries me. This is the end. No more. Take a break.
So, are you familiar with? I want to drop a name here, but it's a name more for Michael than for you, John. Do you know Professor Mark Griffiths' work?
I do.
Okay, so Professor Griffiths did a paper, or co-authored a paper. It's quite a few years ago now, I think. Where it was about smartphone addiction. And the conclusion was, it's not the smartphone, it's the stuff that's on it. Which sort of, it sounds almost simplistic to say it like that. Like, it's not the smartphone itself, that's just the delivery mechanism. It's like, it's not the needle that the heroin addicts are after.
It's not even that. I mean, I think it's multiple components, right? It's also, or the content that people produce out there, because of course, I mean, the smartphone is the device that can deliver it anywhere on the toilet, on the moon, I don't know, in the jungle.
Yeah, but the issue with the smartphone, and obviously we're seeing this in gambling, is that there's still, the smartphone's still new. Like, you know, in research terms, in study terms, in tech terms, the smartphone's still basically in its infancy. And you know, it's already, they've already tried multiple different, you know, do you remember the phablet idea? Who the fuck thought that one up? That was a really bad idea, but sadly nobody asked me. I could have saved them billions.
Yeah.
But you know, it's when you look at how different some gambling markets are, right? So Africa has, a far more mature wireless telecommunications setup than an awful lot of Western countries, because they don't have or didn't have the traditional setup. And obviously Africa is unbelievably massive as well. I mean, it's just vast. So there's not the, you know, no telegraph poles and cables and all of that stuff in most of Africa. So when this technology became available, people were like, holy shit, this is amazing. And the ubiquity of smartphones is unreal. Mm-hmm. And so the penetration of some of these issues, it could be far greater in Africa than anything that's been seen anywhere else before. Yeah. And partly, you know, necessity for communications. Like, my kid, John, am I a bad parent? Two of my kids have got smartphones. One is 10 and one is 13. Am I killing them?
You're probably not killing them. It's become more and more normalized. If you asked me that 10 years ago, probably people would say, oh my God, you're giving your 13-year-old a smartphone. But, you know, things have just become more normalized over the time with technology use.
They're really blasé about it, though. Do you know what I mean? You would think kids their age would be like, holy shit, I've got a smartphone, I'm going to be on TikTok. No.
It's normal. It's, yeah.
My daughter lost her phone for 6 months.
Yeah.
But it, you know, I think that's a good point you're making here. it really also comes down to the child, doesn't it? You know, yeah. Some children are just, you know, more vulnerable to really get hooked to it, to basically, because so I saw children who just can't do anything else. And that's the risk, right? The risk is basically that, you know, it kind of changes, can change your brain plasticity, and these children just can't focus anymore. Like they can't read a book, you know. They can't, you know, sit there and concentrate and do a puzzle, etc. Because these intermittent, you know, reinforcements that you experience with, you know, all the fast content completely sort of, you know, throws you out of balance. I mean, John, I mean, what are kind of the mitigating factors here? Like what are the vulnerabilities for people to really develop an addiction to the phone as opposed to somebody who just doesn't care and can put it away any time of the day they want?
Yeah, are there any common things in there?
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of... there's not just one single cause, but it's genetics. So in terms of the question, I think, is what are the risk factors for someone excessively using the internet, excessively using their smartphone? And research has shown just a number of risk factors. It's genetics, psychopathology, mental disorders, biological abnormalities, how you were raised, your long-standing cognitions and thought patterns early on. So it's like some people who are healthy in this regard, they can have a smartphone and they're not going to excessively use it. They're going to use it when they need to. They're going to use it to build friendships and maintain friendships. But other people who aren't equipped to use it, maybe they come from lower socioeconomic status. Maybe they have a vulnerability to mental disorders. Those are the ones who are going to excessively use the internet as a way to cope with some of their pre-existing problems and vulnerabilities.
This is going to sound like a really bizarre question, right? Just bear with me here. With that in mind, God, this is going to sound bonkers, right? With that in mind, could you... this sounds insane even to me, so that's saying something. I think we can agree, Dr. Howard.
There are no bad questions here.
Oh, there are.
Don't ever say that to me. It's inviting trouble.
Go ahead, John.
Could you use a mobile phone in younger people, well, in anybody, but in younger people, almost as a screening tool then? Could you look at the way somebody uses their mobile phone and say, there might be something else at play here? Let's get in there. Is this something where, you know, teachers could like be a part of a preemptive situation? Do you know what I mean?
Well, that's, you know, assessment is always the first step of, you know, identifying an intervention. And so I don't really see clinical patients anymore because I'm more research focused. But if I was going to see a clinical patient, if they were struggling in some way with addictions or mental health problems, if the mobile phone was part of the issue, I would take a look at it with their permission, with their parents' permission, at their screen time estimates on their phone and see, well, how often are they actually using the phone? What if the parent thinks that the kid is using the phone too much, but actually the kid's not really using the phone too much? And plus, it's hard to kind of gauge things because, you know, maybe the kid is just checking the phone once every half an hour and then just putting it down. They're just checking it for notifications, as opposed to another child who's like literally glued to the phone for hours and hours and hours. So assessment is definitely part of the first step towards identifying, you know, is there a problem? And if so, what's the solution?
How important is environment in this? Right? Because there's been people looking at gambling issues who have, actually Michael Simo and Sarah were doing this. If I remember correctly, they were looking at this and they were saying, well, actually, it's more than the app, it's more than the phone, it's more than any comorbidities. It's where are they? What can they hear? What can they see? What time of day is it? It's all of these things that are factors in it. So say, for example, say you were practicing, right? And say you've got some kids in your waiting room or a kid in your waiting room, and say you used your waiting room as a part of screening, mm-hmm. no pun intended, you could watch the behavior of kids in that, but that would be a craptacular way to do it, because in a waiting room, even I pick up my phone if I've forgotten to take a book with me, you know?
Right.
So it's like that's not going to be an accurate environment in which to look at it, is it?
Yeah. I think you raise some important issues here. One is, I think we need to remember that using a smartphone is a normative behavior at this point in history. We all use it, so we shouldn't over-pathologize it. And what I mean by that is that we should be careful about saying that someone is engaging in too much smartphone use, because everybody's engaging in a good amount of smartphone use. But the other related issue that you're raising is, I think, the context, and it depends on the person and it depends on their situation as to whether they're excessively using the internet. For example, my son works part-time and he also goes to school, so he doesn't really have a lot of extra time in the day to use his smartphone. But for example, my dad is retired and doesn't really have any obligations. He could conceivably use his smartphone for many hours a day, and it wouldn't really cause a problem for him, as long as it wasn't, you know, causing him physical problems. Cause you know, if you're using your phone too much, maybe like your neck would strain or something like that. So it depends on your context and point of life and life circumstances.
I saw in one of your papers, I mean, you're mentioning like, you know, surface learning, procrastination. What's the correlation there between smartphone use?
Yeah, I mean, some people are going to use their smartphone to procrastinate. So, you know, oftentimes we survey college students. So, you know, some people use their phone or the internet to procrastinate from the things that they need to otherwise really get done in life.
So it's kind of it's like disturbs their attention from the actual task at hand. That's what you're saying.
It could either disturb their attention, or they could be using the phone actively in order to avoid getting that task done. Mm. Like, I don't want to really clean the house right now, so I'm just going to use the smartphone instead and distract myself.
What do you think? So lately I came across an online newspaper story, and there was actually a hearing, I think even in US, in Congress, about learning and the internet and smartphones. Sure, maybe you're aware of that. And basically, so what they argue is that every generation until now kind of, you know, assessed through, of course, you know, intelligence tests, was, you know, grew more intelligent than the previous one. So if you looked at, you know, our parents and us, you know, we would sort of fare better in an IQ test than they would, etc., etc. Up to Gen Z now.
Yeah.
So Gen Z was the first generation which fares actually worse in IQ tests than the previous generation. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons given there is actually computer-assisted or digitally-assisted learning. Mm-hmm. What do you think of that?
I think that could be an important reason, and it certainly sounds plausible. But there may also be generational differences with Gen Z. Gen Z are known to be helicopter parented, you know, that expression where like your parents are overprotective of you and they are, you know, and so it's possible that there's a generational difference where Gen Z and I see this in my classes, like now having been teaching since like 1996, in the last few years, Gen Z, they don't often want to learn. They want to be spoon-fed information. They don't like, this is just generality, right? Not every Gen Z kid, but so I think it could be generational differences, not just this technology issue.
Yeah. I mean, what for me, like, you know, personal example is reading. Okay. So when I read a book, an analog book, like a real book with, you know, paper pages and letters, for me, this is like, you know, processing the information in an analog way, you know, mm-hmm. line by line, you know, because that's how the brain, the human brain works, right? The human brain is not a computer where you mm-hmm. can, like in a Matrix, upload, you know, whatever, a yeah. couple of terabytes and, you know, it processes it. We process everything step by step. Or when I studied, you know, statistics, mm-hmm. We wrote down like everything, like literally, you know, pen and paper, like yeah. probability theory, linear equations, logarithm, whatever stuff we did. It was really writing it with chalk on the, you know, on the blackboard
yeah.
and writing it in my, in my notebooks. And mm-hmm. that's totally different from, let's say, using an iPad, you know, for you know, writing formulas or something like that. I think there is something there that, you know, if you process things analog, like step by step, it sticks, you know, more to your brain than doing it, you know, in a digital way.
Yeah, and I've definitely seen research showing that analog writing, taking notes in class, tends to improve outcomes over doing it digitally. However, it could just be that our current generation of people who are technology users just aren't used to doing this yet. So it could be over time that we get better at taking notes digitally. I'm not sure. But I think some of the other issues that you raise, another related issue is the issue of, I'm not sure if you explicitly said this, but I kind of was catching what you were saying, is that younger kids, Gen Z, they might be having some, less boosted intelligence over time compared to the previous generations, because technology might make it hard for them to pay attention. If they're only used to doing the Facebook reels like John is talking about, then it might make them lose focus. But actually, the research has not yet shown a conclusive confidence that, hey, there are attention problems as a result of these newer emerging technologies. So, you know, maybe maybe the research will show that in the future, but so far it hasn't conclusively shown that.
Mm. Yeah.
And I think that also kind of, I think if you really ask kids, like for example, when kids are in my class, kids, I mean like college kids, college students, some of them might have trouble learning the content material, and they say, or I might accuse them, so to speak, of, oh, well, you're just on your phone all the time and it's impairing your concentration. But those same kids might have no problem at all focusing on something that they really want to do, a video that they really want to watch, a book that they really want to read, which they can engage with super focus for hours. But the stuff that we think is important, yeah, if they're not interested in that stuff, then they might have trouble concentrating and paying attention to that.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. Yeah, everybody would like to be 100% hedonistic and do what they want all the time.
If only we could. But I think previous generations before Gen Z might have been better and maybe more respectful in class at paying attention to the stuff that they didn't want to pay attention to. Whereas the newer generation is kind of known for kind of pushing back. I am hearing some echo, and then I noticed John playing with the sound, and now it's back. But for a minute, it was gone. So something that you just got rid of it, I don't know what happens.
Now it's fixed, right, John?
Okay, yeah, it's fixed now.
Don't play around with the technology.
I muted my mic because I could see that it was bouncing even without me speaking.
Okay, yeah.
So I'm sorry, I'll keep it switched off.
What do you think, John? I think you also mentioned you work with the neurology department, neuroscience department.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you think about the role of dopamine?
So I'm not really a big neuroscience guy. I have an affiliation with the department, but I don't really do biological research much. It's not really my strong suit. So. I probably don't have the expertise to really answer your bio-related questions.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely plays a role, But yeah. Even if, I mean, we know it does, but there's really nothing you can do about it, right? I mean, some people just wired differently. They might be more, you know, vulnerable to like intermittent reinforcement in terms of the phone, the reels, gambling, whatever, and others not. I mean, right? Except somebody one day finds a drug to, you know, interfere with the dopamine.
Like a medicine.
Like a medicine. Like, yeah. But who knows where that could lead.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what about your other research? I saw you also research on trauma, PTSD. I mean, is this related to the smartphone research or completely independent?
It's completely independent. Earlier in my career, when I first was a graduate student in 1995, that was my research area and interest was trauma and PTSD and understanding risk factors for PTSD. The internet addictions research I started getting into probably around 2016, and each year since 2016, I've gotten more interested in this internet addictions research and less interested in PTSD research. So that now I don't really do any more PTSD research.
But just because I think it's interesting but for several reasons, because lately, you know, last couple of years, trauma became like an extremely popular concept in terms of, you know, everybody is sort of experiencing some kind of trauma.
Everybody's, you know, blaming something on
nature
trauma.
Versus nurture and so on and so forth. What do you think about that? Like, what's your opinion? Because your research has been, you know, sort of a couple or a decade ago. Do you think, that the concept of the trauma should be expanded so far, or do you think of trauma like really as something like extremely psychologically or physically happening to somebody?
But also, sorry to hijack your question slightly here, Dr. L, is this trauma as defined in your earlier work, or is this a repurposing of the word? And if it's not, is there just a load of crossover there and you haven't realized that you're in fact working on stuff that would like what you're working on before?
it's very different. So basically what I used to work on with post-traumatic stress disorder, the trauma criterion that must be satisfied in order to have a diagnosis of PTSD has to be like severe trauma, you know, where your bodily integrity is threatened. There's a threat to your life, threat of serious injury, actual serious injury, that sort of thing. Sometimes nowadays when people talk about it in society, they talk about trauma, the word trauma, very loosely. Oh, you know, I got yelled at today. That was such a trauma. I was so traumatized. But in terms of the terminology of trauma and PTSD in the mental health and medical field, it has a more specific definition.
I totally agree, but do you think, like, I mean, the way it's used today, especially like among Gen Z, okay, I mean, you yelling at me traumatizes me, or I don't know what, you know?
Or like, oh my God, my professor made me actually talk in class. It was so traumatic. And I think there are more appropriate English words to use, like maybe embarrassing is a better term than traumatic, because if everybody is seen as having a trauma, then we can't really distinguish the really seriously traumatized people from the people who just have everyday experiences of just bad things that happen. Because everybody has like a negative thing that might happen to them at some point.
Yeah. I remember years ago when my stepdaughter Lorna was like 13, 14, something like that. Her and her bestie Katie, they asked me, they were like, oh, what does, they're asking me to explain something. So I'm explaining it. And I used a word that they were unfamiliar with. And they were like, what does that mean? So I told them the definition of the word. And they said, why didn't you just say that? I'm like, I did. That's exactly what I did say. I just used one word that has a precise meaning in the correct context. And there's a precision to language that is, it's not being eroded, because language is obviously extremely fluid, But somebody reading academic papers in 50 years is gonna read something very, very differently to what was written.
Yeah, true. Language does change over time.
But I also think it's important to be specific. Like, for example, for me, you know, in gambling, using gaming sort of, you know, is wrong for me, you know, because gaming is something else than gambling. And very often gaming is used just to make it look, you know, more entertaining, whatever, less adult, because everybody knows, you know, everybody connects something with gambling. Everybody knows, okay, it's something you do when you're 18, whatever, you know, it involves money, etc., etc. But gaming sounds, you know, more harmless. And that's why, you know, they kind of, you know, mix up the terminology. But
that's a very, very common criticism of the gambling industry.
Yeah.
Usually by anti-gambling critics.
Yeah,
But I don't think that it's, certainly in my experience within, it's not used in a sort of a duplicitous way. Nobody's trying to pull the wool over anybody's eyes. The terms are just used interchangeably. Mm. Well, but I think now more than ever, especially with what we're seeing with loot boxes and game design, there is way more overlap than there's ever been.
Well, I'll also bring this back to your question earlier, John, was when we were talking about asking people survey questions about their mental health and things like that. So the good questionnaires that we use, standardized questionnaires, we try not, those questionnaires don't typically have ambiguous words that the person giving the questionnaire might have a difference of opinion on from the person rating their symptoms on. Like we're not going to ask someone, are you experiencing symptoms of trauma? Instead, we're going to ask in these questionnaires more specific questions that are tied to behaviors. So that to make sure that we're on this, that the psychologist is on the same page as the patient, so to speak, the research participant, so that there's not the ambiguity. So that's an important issue because of some of the ambiguity of language.
Yeah, I certainly think, you know, in the gambling industry, that ambiguity has provided ammunition for the industry's critics, no question.
Yeah, and addiction would be another kind of ambiguous term. I don't usually use the term addiction to refer to overuse of the smartphone or social media. I instead use terms like problematic use. There's not really adequate evidence that a smartphone can be truly addictive in the sense of a behavior that's a true addictive disorder, like alcohol use disorders and things like that.
Because addiction is a very precise word.
Exactly. Same sort of issue. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very important to distinguish because it's thrown around a lot, right? You're an addict. And I mean, in reality, there isn't a clear definition. And in gambling, for example, what's problem gambling? What's disordered gambling? What's gambling addiction? I mean, there is gambling disorder. That's what it's called in the DSM-5, but nobody talks about gambling addiction.
And then on the other side, when we use these technical terms like problematic gambling or problematic smartphone use, the lay public don't understand it. Okay. They understand addiction.
Exactly.
So then there's that issue too of like, you know, among professionals, we use the technical terms, but then we probably need to kind of use the lay terms create new lay terms when talking to the lay public.
Well, it's a fantastic area where some standardization would be welcome, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Before you mentioned the DSM, so is there, I mean, is problematic internet use, smartphone use, is any of this actually an official DSM-5 criteria?
No, none of them are in the DSM-5. In America, we use the DSM-5. Some parts of the world use the DSM-5. A lot of parts of the world use the ICD, International mm-hmm. Classification of Diseases. Neither of those diagnostic manuals have a problematic smartphone or social media use diagnosis. Although both of the diagnostic manuals do have a gaming disorder diagnosis, but not these other types of diagnoses, I still research problematic smartphone use and problematic social media use. Even though they're not official diagnoses, they still are concerning phenomenon. They do seem to create problems in people.
But does this have an impact? Because gambling disorder is an official diagnosis since the DSM-5, which came out, I think, in 2010 or 12, or, you know,
13, yeah.
13, sorry, and the smartphone shopping addiction, internet use, not. Does this kind of have an impact on financing of the research grants or?
I think probably you're right. I think that it's probably easier to get research funding for an actual research topic that actually is a diagnosis. Mm-hmm. I've also written papers in the past that have said, why is there a gaming disorder diagnosis but not a problematic social media diagnosis? If someone is equally afflicted with one, you know, if two different people have the same symptoms and the same disease burden, but one person is because of gaming, the other person is because of social media, why is it that we have a gaming disorder diagnosis but not one of these other diagnoses? That might change in the future. It is something that I wonder about.
But most likely, right, it's going to be added, or some of those are going to be added as behavioral addictions.
It could be, especially as you said, DSM-5, you know, it came out 2013. That was a long time ago. There have been incremental updates, but in terms of the next major update, I don't know when that's planned for. So that could change.
Does that create any difficulties not fitting into these pre-assigned boxes for what you're looking at? Does that create any difficulties with... not necessarily with funding, but with because you've got to like carve your own niche then, right? Because this is you know, I said earlier, like smartphones are still pretty new tech. I know they've been around for ages, but they also haven't been around for ages. Mm-hmm. So has that created any problems for you in getting data, in getting funding, in being taken seriously, or has everybody just gone fuck yeah?
I don't think I've seen any problems, you know, in my own research. I've been able to consistently publish research studies on problematic smartphone use, problematic social media use. I do often mention in the introduction to many of my papers, hey, we should provide the caveat, this is not an actual diagnosis in the DSM-5 or ICD-11. But I also mention in the introduction of these papers that, you know, problematic smartphone use, problematic social media use, they can lead to physiological problems, problems with your neck and hands of overuse, driving collisions, pedestrian accidents, and that sort of thing. So that's why these constructs are still concerning.
That's interesting what you're bringing up. I mean, like, don't text and drive. I mean, has been popular for decades. It's interesting. I mean, like, you know, if you were able to correlate, let's say, motor vehicle accidents with excessive smartphone use.
Yeah, that's been done in research. Yeah, I mean, in a lot of studies, a number of different of these kind of adverse outcomes have been supported.
I can imagine somebody in a court case saying, hey, I'm an addict, you know, I couldn't help it. I had to text.
This goes back to John's comment before about everybody's looking for a culprit. And some people are looking for a culprit for the problems that afflict them in life. And so they might claim, yeah, well, it wasn't me. It was my smartphone that did it. It wasn't me. It was the alcohol that did it. You know, that sort of thing. But ultimately, we live in a society where we have to take personal responsibility for our decisions, and this might be going off in a tangent, but we all have responsibility for things, but the tech companies do have some responsibility too. And you might know that the tech companies have been interested in getting people hooked into using their phones and social media for more and more time. And they have created addictive elements that go into their tech platforms to keep, like the Facebook Reels, for example, to keep people on the platform for longer and longer in order to generate more advertisement revenue and to generate more data that these companies can sell to data brokers. So yes, I have personal responsibility if I am using technology too much, but also the technology firms also have some responsibility, kind of like going back to the cigarette tobacco companies that were known to put addictive elements in their cigarettes specifically to get people addicted to cigarettes. And we all know what happened as a consequence is that the tobacco companies have lost a lot of money over the years in expensive lawsuits.
That's an interesting, interesting parallel.
Yeah. But again, still, tobacco smokers need to take responsibility. But it's like, yes, you know, I don't want to attribute all responsibility to one person or one entity, but it seems like there's a good amount of responsibility and blame to go around.
Yeah. So like in gambling, I always say that regulations overlap with personal responsibility. They don't replace personal responsibility.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I'm a bit too good at getting drunk. So what I do is I don't buy alcohol. I mean, that's just me. It's not so easy for other people. It's not so simple for other people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you kind of, it's one of the things about the US that's both really interesting and would probably really be really frustrating if I were working in an area where there were obviously well known, well understood problematic behaviors. So looking at gambling in the US, it's 50 different countries, really. And people, from what I understand, and my brother's lived in the States for decades, but from what I understand, people really push, everybody very strongly pushes back against federal oversight.
Yeah.
But actually, in the context of something like gambling regulations, federal oversight would be fantastic.
Yeah.
Because it would give a baseline that everybody can work from and that states can build from. It would simplify everything for everybody. Yeah. You know, it's... But there's always that opposition to federal government interference, I suppose, or what might be seen as interference. And I wonder if that, you know, I wonder if that's something that you look at as an academic and think, shit, not this again. Or are you an anti-federalist? Is that what we're talking about here?
No, I'm a Democrat, not a Republican. Republicans tend to want to minimize government interference. Democrats like to kind of assume, you know what, we need the government to help pull us up from our bootstraps. And so I think what a lot of Republicans, congressmen, congresswomen, senators in the U.S., they often like to be hands-off. Oh, they'll say the tech companies... they'll say, you know, the tech companies, this is a free country, so the tech companies need to regulate themselves. But of course, that's ridiculous. Companies are not going to regulate themselves.
Yeah, we've all seen what happens there.
Absolutely.
Those but aforementioned tobacco companies.
Exactly. Same thing. Right. And that's probably what they were saying back then. Oh, it's fine. Tobacco companies can regulate themselves. They know
they don't want the experts. To die.
Exactly. But it also, even Republicans, they do at times know kind of what moves society. And there is a movement in society currently about the harms that can be caused from social media companies. So there have been regulations, of course, not only in other parts of the world, but also more recently in the U.S. to impose age restrictions on social media use, smartphone bans in school. I'm not necessarily supportive of these things. I'm just saying, like, there has been movement recently in regulations recently in the U.S.
That's what I actually wanted to ask you. Like in Australia, they introduced it. In Austria, they have also passed a law or attempting to pass a law to ban social media for children. What do you think about it?
Yeah, so I think that there needs to be some sort of mitigation of harm, but I don't know that smartphone bans and things like identity verification for social media use are the best ways. One main issue that we have with smartphone bans in the U.S. is at the same time that we want to protect our kids from smartphones, we also have a ton of school shootings in America. Mm-hmm. And I want my kids to have their easy access to their smartphone so that they can call the police in case that there's a school shooting. And that's one of the biggest oppositions to smartphone bans in schools in America, is that parents want to be able to reach their kids, or vice versa, for their kids to call the authorities. Mm. So the other issue that's being talked about in society right now is that social media use causes mental health harms to adolescents. But actually, most of the experts in this area, most of the theoretical frameworks, conceptualize it differently. It's actually most likely mental health problems that drive some kids to excessively use social media.
Yeah, it's always same with gambling, right? Yeah. We know there's lots of comorbidity.
Yeah.
Does it create a problem, or is it the symptom, yeah, of the problem?
Yeah. I don't think that social media will cause mental disorder unless we're talking about someone who is already vulnerable to a mental disorder, or if they have a mental disorder, sure, using social media could make it a little bit worse for them. But I don't think that it's likely that any technology, there's never been in the history of psychiatric research that a major causal factor for mental disorder has been any sort of new emerging technology use. And the research on adolescence in terms of associations with mental health has really conflicting mixed findings. I can't really confidently conclude based on the research that social media use is a causal factor in mental disorder. The caveats would be, and this goes back to kind of the contextual questions that John was raising before, is it matters what you see on social media or what you do on social media. If you're being cyberbullied, if you're being cyberstalked, if you're witnessing really traumatic content online, well, sure, that could cause mental disorder. Mm-hmm. But the normal kinds of social media use that most people see on an everyday basis, I don't think that that's going to cause a first-time mental disorder that wasn't already going to appear there.
Good point. Good closing words, I think. John, what do you think?
I think you're exactly right, Dr. Hauer. I mean, apart from your traditional closing words.
Do I have to get to the chopper?
I'm curious to hear them.
It's very simple.
My closing words is that I have to get to the chopper.
Okay. Dr. Hauer is Austrian, and so is that nice Mr. Schwarzenegger, who, of course, famously said, "Get to the chopper!" in Predator.
Is that better than saying hasta la vista, baby?
I think it's far better.
Okay.
I'm one of those rare people that thinks Terminator was far better than Terminator 2.
Yeah. The classic, the OG.
Oh, it was just glorious. So good.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's amazing what you can do. You know the phrase, necessity is the mother of invention.
Yeah, sure.
They do so much in that movie with so little money. And the second movie, yeah, they do loads, but they used all the money in the world.
Yeah.
I always used to say that the nuclear bomb scene in Terminator 2,
yeah,
Sarah Connor has that sort of dream about the playground and all of that. That scene cost almost the same amount to make as the entirety of Evil Dead 2. And I have seen Evil Dead 2 far more times than I've seen Terminator 2.
Okay.
Just throwing that out there.
Perfect closing point.
Thank you for listening. And John, thank you so much for joining us. It's been bonkers, actually. It's been, but in a good way.
Super discussion.
My pleasure.
Yeah.
Thank you.